Some of our listeners will probably disagree with this, but I would say that I think the future of the Jewish people is going to get written on this stage more than any other stage. And I decided that we wanted to be actors on the stage and not sitting in the front row watching.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
Good morning. I am Alex Israel. I have the distinct pleasure this morning in Shalem College of sitting with Rabbi Dr. Daniel Gordis. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Daniel Gordis is the author of many eminently readable and insightful books. Most lately, his work, Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn, has won the National Book Award. And I just want to wish you mazal tov for this wonderful achievement. Daniel Gordis' day job, if he has one, I don't know what he manages to pack into a day, is a senior vice president and chair of the core curriculum here at Shalem College. So I'm really, really excited to be sitting with you and talking to you. And I wanted to start off by asking you a question which goes earlier into your biography. I know that you're famous for advocating for Israel and you've written a lot about Israel over the last two decades. But I know that you started your career as a conservative rabbi and a dean of a rabbinical school. From our perspective at Pardes, I'm really curious, what brought you to a point where you decided to be a rabbi and to go in that direction?
When I got to college in the late 70s, my grandfather, Robert Gordis, who was a well-known Bible scholar and was on the faculty of JTS, was living in New York also, a couple miles away. So I ended up studying with him three times a week. We'd learn Gemara a couple times during the week. I'd go for Shabbat afternoon. And I remember towards the end of my first year, when I had already planned to be not only a lawyer, but a Supreme Court justice, I went over with a friend who was actually the grandson of a friend of my grandfather's. So he was kind of a peer of mine, and his grandfather and my grandfather were friends. And my grandfather said to him, do you want to be a rabbi? And I remember my friend said, oh my God, no. And the moment that he said that, I had this sense, well, why would you not want to do that? That's such a cool thing to do. You get to sit and study Torah all the time, like your job is to learn. And I kind of had this instinct in response to him. It was actually really in response to hearing a friend of mine saying it was the last thing in the world that he wanted to do, that I realized it was something that I really thought I should consider seriously. I was new to learning with my grandfather, but I, thank God, grown up in a home where, you know, learning was a serious part of life. And I realized if you can make a life out of reading and teaching and learning the things that you love, why would you do anything else?
Wow. I know that as a conservative rabbi, and when you were at the Ziegler Rabbinical School, I think you were seen on the right flank of the conservative movement. And in your book, God Was Not in the Fire, you advocate very strongly for a Judaism of obligation and of study. If I recall, you even talk about the idea that Judaism has to be a struggle, that people are looking for an easy life in Judaism, and Judaism should be hard in some sense. So can you expand a little bit? I think this was sort of a mission that you were on at that point in time. What does all that mean, and do you think it's more relevant, less relevant in today's world?
Well, I grew up in a family of conservative rabbis. As I said before, my grandfather was a well-known Bible scholar at JTS. My mother's brother was Gerson Cohen, who was the chancellor of JTS. My father's younger brother, David Gordis, was eventually the president of Hebrew College in Boston, but was also a conservative rabbi. So I grew up with all these conservative rabbis in my family, but grew up in Orthodox shuls. It just was the way it was, both when we lived in Baltimore and for a while when we lived in Israel as I was a kid. We always just davened in Orthodox shuls. So for me, I kind of knew that I was a part of that world, but I'd grown up with the norms of a different world. And when I got to college and began to think more systematically about where I belonged, one thing that seemed to me to be clear was that what had made Judaism survivable for millennia was the notion that it was not a system of belief only, or even at all, we could have that conversation at some point, but that kind of a minimal bar was a sense of a suspension of a certain degree of our autonomy, that I couldn't just do whatever I wanted whenever I wanted to do it and call it Judaism in any way that, to me at least, reflected what you see in the Chumash, what you see in Sifrut Chazal, what you see in the world of Shelot and Tshuvot. In other words, if you want to have a Judaism, it seemed to me, and obviously a lot of people disagree with this, but to me at least it seemed that if you want to have a Judaism that is reflective of 2,000 years of Jewish engagement, a fundamental commitment there was a suspension of a degree of autonomy, which in English means that there's certain things that I have to do, whether it's prayer, whether it's what I eat, whether it's what I wear, whether it, any dimension of life, how I spend my money, what kind of language I use, and so on and so forth. When I was at the University of Judaism at the first stage of my career, we had an opportunity some number of years in to separate from JTS, for which we had been doing the first couple of years of rabbinic training, following which students would then go off to New York. It's a whole complicated political, internal rabbinical thing. And we had an opportunity. Never happens in the Jewish world. That was the one time. And we had an opportunity due to a very, very, very generous donor, Ruth Ziegler, hence the name of the Ziegler School, to actually go independent. And a number of us had a sense that we could do it differently, that we could actually have a conservative rabbinical school that would restore a certain element of the Yirat Shamayim that some of us felt was perhaps beginning to ebb, a real love of learning that was still very much in place at JTS in those days, may still be now, I don't know, but also a much more substantial commitment to halakha than at least had been the case at JTS when I was there. Now, JTS was much further to the right when I was there than it is now, but even then it was much further to the left than it had been when my grandfather had gone in the 1940s or 50s, I guess. I think we were both successful and abysmal failures at the same time. We were successful inside the four walls of the Ziegler School. We really created a special community in which a very significant part of the students were really doing serious learning. We created a community in which halachic discourse was very much a part of the world in which we lived. And we had a lot of students who were pretty observant. What I did not understand, because I was young and naive, was that the reality of the conservative world was going to, like a tidal wave, take most of them over almost instantaneously. In other words, you could have all these various commitments, but if you were committed to working in the conservative world, there weren't that many communities where you could insist on a whole set of things and not be considered an oddball. By the way, it's really important to point out that there have been certain exceptions to that. And for example, Rabbi Sharon Brous, who was a student at Ziegler for a while and then went on and finished at JTS, who's well known for her political views on Israel, which are quite to the left, is actually a very seriously halakhically committed person. I don't take any credit for that personally, and I don't even think Ziegler had a tremendously important role in that. But there are people who are exceptions to what I'm saying, which is the only thing that's important to point out. So I don't know what happens at Ziegler now. The person who took over for me, Rabbi Brad Artson, is extremely talented, but he's been there 20 years almost. No idea what goes on. But I had hoped that we could create a kind of a new kind of conservative rabbi. We did and we didn't.
So it was about, what you were talking about was about the rabbinate. But what about the amcha? What about the people? In other words, if you were calling for people to increase in study, if you were looking for people to start taking on certain commitments and sort of changing their lifestyle and reading, realizing that Judaism doesn't just sort of fold around you, but you've got to actually make it happen. Do you think your call was heeded? What were the sort of reactions? And maybe I'm going to even add that a couple of years ago, you wrote a piece where you spoke about a requiem for conservative Judaism. And I think maybe talking about some of these themes, you issued this call. Where do you think it's gone? Or what do you think the response has been? But not on the leadership level and not on the rabbinic level, but on the level of people in North America and the way Judaism is being kept.
There's been a huge slide. In my estimation, I think that the Jewish world in the United States is exceedingly different from when it was when I was in rabbinical school almost 30 years ago. It's even very different than it was when I left the States 18 years ago. When I was in rabbinical school, I still remember picking up a magazine in the library and for the first time coming across this term, Jewish continuity. One of the critical studies that had come out at that point had just come out raising all these questions about Jewish continuity. Everybody was schreiing gewalt. But it was the first time in my adult life that I was, oh, somebody's worried about us surviving. I mean, nowadays that sounds funny. You know, you're smiling, I'm smiling. Because how could a Jew actually be a sentient human being and not know that there's a challenge to Jewish survival? But there I was sitting in the JTS library reading, whether it was Moment magazine or whatever it was at the time, and somebody had written a piece about Jewish continuity, a word that eventually came, it sort of left the stage because people recognized that the question isn't continuity, the question is the substance of continuity. So that phrase went out of vogue for a while. But the mere fact that I was already an adult when the first time that the Jewish community was talking about the issue of Jewish continuity because of the National Jewish Population Survey in the United States sometime in the early 80s says a tremendous amount. Intermarriage in conservative Jewish life at that point was a serious no-no. Was there conservative? Was there intermarriage? Of course there was. Were there any conservative rabbis at all talking about the need for the conservative movement to embrace or permit or engage with intermarriage? None whatsoever. Intermarriage has soared. There are conservative rabbis who actually perform intermarriages, although they've been booted out of the movement. There's one rabbi in Boston who has not actually done it, but he's on record as saying he thinks the movement should do it. The movement has moved dramatically to the left. That's one major change. The other major change, whether it's a cause and effect, is a good argument to have, is that the conservative movement, which when I was in rabbinical school was by far the largest denomination in the United States, is nowhere near that anymore. It has shrunk absolutely and relatively. The number of Jews who affiliate with it is lower. The percentage of Jews who affiliate it with lower. Reform is now the largest. And it's still shrinking. So when I wrote the Requiem for Conservative Judaism in the Jewish Review of Books, it was about trying to say that the conservative movement needed to stand for something if it had any hope of recouping any of the ground that it had lost. I think where Orthodoxy really has done it right, and I don't mean theologically or halachically, but sociologically. In the 1950s, I think Nachum Glaser wrote this, an introduction to the second version of his book, American Judaism, or I forget what it was called, in which he said basically that he hadn't really included Orthodoxy because it was kind of obvious that Orthodoxy's days were past and the future of American Judaism did not include the Orthodox Jewish world. Very similar, by the way, what Ben-Gurion said about Haredim in Israel. People right. had a sense that they sort of saw the beginning of the end of these movements. Of course, Orthodoxy in America had a huge comeback in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And I think that part of what it did is it simply didn't compromise. It wasn't meant to be a mass movement. It was meant to be a movement for people that really understood that making that suspension of autonomy we were talking about before makes a space in your soul for a kind of passion and a kind of devotion that I think religious life is all about. And what I was basically saying is if you're just going to offer kind of Shabbat services and you know, sort of the nice and easy, there's really no reason that people should not gravitate more towards the Reform movement. It's more flexible liturgically. It embraces your kids who intermarry. There's really nothing to say for yourself unless you're going to actually take part of what the Orthodox world has done and insist on halachic commitment. I think it's a little late. I don't think it's going to happen. I made that clear in the article. It wasn't terribly popular in conservative circles, but that's way it goes.
Difficult to appreciate why it wouldn't be popular there. Okay, following forward, and this is really fascinating, you decided to make Aliyah. And as I said, over the last two decades, you've really become a voice of Israel and a spokesperson for Israel and advocate. So I'm curious, what brought you here? What made you make Aliyah? And probably you're going to say what a lot of us say who make Aliyah, that the reasons why I came aren't necessarily the reasons why I love being here. I'm really curious to hear your journey and what brought you here and what made you stay.
There's a two-word answer and a somewhat longer answer. The two-word answer, which is totally true, is my wife. In other words, she was the one, when we were actually dating, it made it very clear she wanted to live here. When I proposed, actually, in our junior year here in Jerusalem, in what was then a very nice little bar, but is now the Eldon car rental place. It was a very nice little bar back then.
Sounds very romantic.
It was actually very romantic back then. Nowadays, it wouldn't be so romantic, but it was very romantic back then. And it was right next to the YMCA. So it was between, I think it was between Christmas and New Year's, and it was all decorated in Christmas lights, and it was all very, very beautiful. But in any event, when I asked her to marry me, she said yes, on the condition we can move to Israel, to which I said, that's seriously not happening. And then we came for a sabbatical a number of years later, 98, I think it was. And we were really going to stay for only 1 year. We left two cars in the driveway in Los Angeles and rented our house to one of my students and left everything, you know, the clothing and the dresser drawers and the whole shebang. And first of all, in the middle of that year, she said, I'm not going back. And I knew she really meant it. Number two, we had made a lot of decisions in our marriage based on my career, and I felt it was like her turn. And I told her if I can find a job where we can actually make a living and put bread on the table during the week and challah on the table on Shabbat, I'll give it a shot. And I was also really beginning to feel, you have to remember that 98, those were the heady days. Barak beat Netanyahu. He made three promises. Remember, peace with the Syrians, peace with the Palestinians, and getting the boys out of Lebanon. He did the latter. The other two kind of didn't go so well. It was a very heady time in Israel. It was really a time when the left and the right disagreed about whether Israel should make the deal that it was making, but everybody understood that it was going to make the deal and there was going to be an agreement with the Palestinians. There was a small, crazy group on the right who felt that was never going to happen.
Right.
But, you know, it was a very heady time here. My wife wanted to make Aliyah. I felt it was her turn. And I was really beginning to feel that there was a kind of a purposefulness to life here that we didn't have in LA, and I'd never felt really in the States. And of course, fast forwarding almost 20 years, I think it's safe to say that, again, what brought us here may not be the same thing that kept us here. What's kept us here is a real sense of purpose and a real sense of mission, a community, the sorts of which we didn't have in LA, even though we lived in a wonderful community in LA. It's just very different here, as all of us know who live here. And I've never really looked back. As you know, there have been some dark times. 2000 to 2004 was not so fun. All of our kids went to the Army, one especially in a very serious, dangerous unit, and you have some very long nights waiting to hear back. But I never looked back. I think some of our listeners will probably disagree with this, but I would say that I think the future of the Jewish people is going to get written on this stage more than any other stage. And I decided that we wanted to be actors on the stage and not sitting in the front row watching.
Okay, so in our earlier segment of the conversation, you spoke about how you felt in some way that the movement in which you'd grown up is sort of stagnating. And last week you were at Pardes launching your new book, and you spoke about a sort of a renaissance of Judaism here in the state of Israel. So if we've spoken about sort of a Judaism which is becoming less relevant or less committal in the United States, can you tell us a little more about this, what you're witnessing here in Israel? I mean, there are so many stories taking place here, but I'm going to hone in on this one, which is the Jewish Renaissance, as you call it, or a renaissance of Judaism within the state of Israel, Judaism coming alive in new ways. And I'm really fascinated about this whole phenomenon. So maybe you could elaborate a little bit, since it is a huge section of your book.
It's a huge section of the book. It's also a huge topic. But to do it somewhat briefly, I think that there's a fascinating phenomenon of kids after high school going to Mechinot Dan Svayot, these one-year programs before the army, where secular religious kids get together. And it's mostly the secular kids who are fascinating to me, who are saying basically, I didn't learn this stuff when I was in high school. I don't necessarily want to become observant, but I don't want to be severed from the conversation that's been Judaism for thousands of years. There are lots of kids after the army who are going back to Mabua, for example, at Ein Prat, and are taking either 6 months or a few weeks in Elul and are beginning to study. There are study groups on all of Israel's major campuses where even non-religious kids who don't have a lot of textual background are finding their way in.
Finding their way into a conversation
in which
Torah?
Jewish texts are the root of the conversation. Yeah.
Jewish traditional texts.
Yeah. Torah, Chazal, might be Chassidut, it might be Rav Kook. But yeah, I mean, something ancient, or really relatively ancient. I think that there's a lot of reasons for that. I think part of it is the exhaustion of the kind of hyper-secularist Zionism, of which Ben-Gurion was the kind of the emblematic representative. That's all tired and gone. In other words, all those people, Ben-Gurion and Peres and Eliezer Ben-Yehuda, and one can name all those people, they all grew up in frum homes in Europe and left that world. So what they never really understood, Chaim Nachman Bialik was an example of that, they never really understood the degree to which the world that they had abandoned still animated them. In other words, David Ben-Gurion had a huge love of Tanakh, and in the old days, it's not there anymore, I don't know why, but when you go to his house in Sde Boker, his Tanakh was actually on his desk. They've moved it. It's really sad because the Tanakh was really falling apart, and it was held together by a little string that he would tie together. He could have gotten a Tanakh, right? I mean, as the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, he could have probably asked his secretary, could you get me a Tanakh? And there was probably one around somewhere. But he wanted that Tanakh, which he'd clearly had for a very, very, very long time. It's not an exaggeration to say that David Ben-Gurion's grandchildren do not have that love of Tanakh. And it's not an exaggeration to say that if Chaim Nachman Bialik had been fortunate enough to have children and grandchildren, which unfortunately he wasn't, that his grandchildren would not have understood his poetry, because they would have grown up in the secular world of Tel Aviv, and they would have not gotten the education that you need to understand Be'ir HaHariga or HaMatmid or any of those poems. I think that there was a kind of hyper-secularist, rebellious early generation of Zionism which wanted out of the dark, dank yeshiva of Europe and all of the rigors of that life, but didn't appreciate how much that life that they were abandoning still animated them on a day-to-day level. A couple of generations later, especially, I argue in the book, and not everybody agrees with this contention, but I argue in the book that a lot of this is 73, that we're in many ways still recovering from the 73 war and the loss of the euphoria between 67 and 73. And now I think you couple that to the fact that our generation really does not believe that there's any solution to the conflict with the Palestinians in sight, maybe even in our lifetimes, then you've got to have a very different sense of why do I keep living here?
Right. I I remember hearing an interview on the radio with Barry Sakharov. And if you look up Barry Sakharov on YouTube, the first thing that comes up when you look him up is a nigun of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, Barry Sakharov is uber secular.
Right.
And he said, I remember him telling, they said, how did you get into all this Hasidut stuff? And he said exactly that. He said, I was going through after all the years where we were so excited about peace. And then we had those years of Intifada. And I said, wait, I don't understand. Why do they still hate us? Why are we still struggling? And he said, suddenly, you know, the penny dropped or the asimon dropped. And he said, I think it's got something to do with Judaism, but I don't know anything about Judaism.
Right. So that's the perfect representation of exactly what we're saying. And I think it's happening to literally tens of thousands, or if not hundreds of thousands, of young people in Israel. It's not sweeping everyone along, obviously. But there's a renaissance of Judaism in the Jewish state. And I think that's one of the most fascinating dimensions of what's unfolding here.
See, what you're saying is really fascinating, and I identify it. You can identify it on the playlist of Galei Tzahal, where there are more and more both, you know, songs with Jewish meaning and all of that.
I think Meir Banai, who died last week, how much, even as a secular Jew, his work was infused with the work of Yehuda Halevi and many others.
Right. Do you think it's going to change also the religious Zionist world, which is connected to Zionism and to Orthodoxy? On one hand, you're saying that the secularists or secular Israelis are sort of warming to Judaism. Is it going to do something? You know, we talk about different sectors, different tribes in modern Israel. Do you think this is going to change the religious Zionist world?
Well, I think the religious Zionist world faces a different kind of a challenge. If the challenge of the secular world was to open itself up to the rigors of Jewish life and the Jewish conversation, let's say, I think increasingly the challenge of the religious Zionist world is to open itself up to the conversations of the West. In other words, democracy is not really a concept deeply embedded in Masechet Sanhedrin. You will look through, you know, all of the Rambam long and hard and not find any discussion of representative government. A large part of what makes Israel tick is actually not only Jewish, but also Western. And what worries me about the religious Zionist world these days is that it's inching to the right, not only politically, but it's inching to the right and narrowing itself intellectually. And the days of people kind of going to college and reading John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and Hume and Hobbes and so on and so forth, and then studying Torah at the same time, and Reza Rav Soloveitchik is probably the preeminent example, or Rabbi Jonathan Sacks is another, you know, world-class example. Weaving those two things together, I think that that's actually on the wane. There are still very important personalities who represent that in Israel and in the religious Zionist world, but not as many as there need to be and as many as there should be. So my concern actually for the religious Zionist world is not the question of whether they're also going to kind of change their religiosity. Is A, it's how far is their political needle going to move to the right, and what's that going to do to Israel's flexibility if and when the opportunity comes to do something to put this thing to rest? And number two, the more they move to the right and the less they become open to the thought of the West, to what extent does that move Israel more into the world of a cloistered religious leadership, which I personally think would be very dangerous? We see how what it's done in the Arab world, it has not been terribly pretty.
Right. Wow. Okay, that's quite a challenge. So I'm going to try and bridge us back across the pond now, and say that many people have noticed that young Jews, young millennial Jews, and we've spoken sort of about an America where the mainstream is moving, how should we call it, leftwards, and you've spoken about an Israel moving maybe more towards its Judaism. And a lot of people have spoken about young millennial Jews in the United States and around the world moving away from Israel, finding Israel even sometimes embarrassing, a clash with their value system, which is very liberal, very humanist, and the particularist Israel. Never mind the issues of Israel and the Palestinians. And people have spoken about this sort of rupture. Where do you think this is going? Or, and maybe I'll ask him maybe more positive, because you might say awful. I'm not sure what you're going to say. But is there anything to be done? Is there anything to be done to sort of heal that, or to sort of redirect? Do you think American Jews could do without Israel in their worldview? How would we map this out?
Well, that's a great question and a complicated one. But to kind of put it into bullet points, I think, first of all, the gap between American Jews and Israel is growing, and some of that's natural because these are very different enterprises. The universalist America with a public square that is mostly devoid of religion, that's part of what made America work, was that religion was privatized and not the... Now it's changing because of the evangelicals, it's changing because of much of what's happening in the Republican Party. But when I was growing up, it was pasnished, as we say in Yiddish, whether it was Jews or Christians, to make the public square theirs. The public square was American precisely because it was pretty devoid of religious discourse. Now, that's changed in America a little bit, but still not nearly as much as the public square in Israel, which was meant to be Jewish. In other words, this is a country of the Jews, by the Jews, and for the Jews, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, where America was meant to be ethnic, religious, neutral. This country is not. This country, as you noted yourself, is highly particularistic. This America is obviously, by design, almost highly universalistic. Americans, increasingly, especially young Americans, are very troubled by the notion of American exceptionalism, and Barack Obama made a point of never talking about American exceptionalism and saying, when asked, that he believed in American exceptionalism the way he believed in German exceptionalism and British exceptionalism, which is to say, he didn't believe in American exceptionalism. Israelis believe in Israeli exceptionalism. We believe, even secular Israelis, who are not necessarily part of that religious conversation we're talking about, when they go to Tzahal and they put their lives on the line, they're saying intrinsically that there's something here that's worth sacrificing for, and it's got to be Jewish at its core. So in many ways, these two projects are very, very different, and it's natural to a certain extent that they would grow apart. And yet, Israeli Jews need American Jews to care, and American Jews need Israel to survive. American Jews carry themselves with the self-confidence that they have, because Israel has restored Jews to a place in the international stage that Chechens don't feel, and that Basques don't feel, and that Kurds don't feel. Those are all very noble traditions, and they have their own histories and so forth, but they don't have countries. And therefore, they're constantly tiptoeing around, waiting to see what's going to happen to them next. And Jews stopped tiptoeing around in 1967. It wasn't 48, it wasn't 56, it wasn't 47, it was 67.
My parents always say that in London, Jews wouldn't walk around with a kippah in the streets until after 1967.
That's true in America also. And by the way, Soviet Jews began to rattle their cage in 67. Until then, who needed it? Why move from the Soviet Union to a place where you were constantly getting infiltrated in the 1950s and shot at? 67, the Soviet Jews heard about this. They said, oh, that is a different story. That's something I could be part of. And the notion of what a Jew was had changed. 22 years between the liberation of Auschwitz and paratroopers bursting their way through the Lion's Gate. That's a whole different Jew. And American Jews today, even the ones who are very anti-Israel, don't understand the degree to which it's Israel's existence and what Israel's done for the sense the Jews have of themselves that enables them, ironically, to be so critical. They're not nervous anymore, and they're not nervous precisely because there's an Israel. At the same time, Israeli Jews need to understand, and I think many do, but some don't, first of all, that we desperately need America's support. I mean, we just do. $3 billion a year is not a small thing. The fact that everybody got so upset that the U.S. did not veto the U.N. resolution a few weeks ago is indicative of the fact that we really expect America to have our back internationally, and Europe is not about to turn towards Israel, especially in a Trump era, it seems to me. We're going to need America for the foreseeable future, and while Jews are a relatively small number in America, they are the backbone of American support for Israel. That's part of it. But American Jews, you know, who have come to Israel and who influence Israel, have also brought something very unique to Israel. We're sitting in South Jerusalem. We're sitting in Shalem College, which is really an American idea. It's an American four-year liberal arts college funded, quite frankly, mostly by private individuals from the United States. You're here representing Pardes, which is a distinctly Western notion. Israel was not going to spring this thing up on its own. It took, and I'm assuming that most of Pardes's support still comes from the United States. And that's not accidental, because there's a kind of an openness, an egalitarianism. I don't mean, by the way, only halachic male-female egalitarianism, but a kind of an openness to all different Jewish walks of life, which is much more Western than it is Israeli. There are all different sorts of ways, cultural, economic, military, diplomatic, and so forth, in which Israel needs America. So I'm saying two contradictory things. One is that the chasm is by definition going to stretch and get wider and wider. And yet at the very same time, we have to work very hard to bridge it however we can. And I think the main way to do that is try to understand each other. And one of the reasons that I wrote this History of Israel the way that I did was somebody pointed out yesterday in a session here at Shalem that there's many fewer generals and politicians than there are poets and philosophers in the book. And that's actually probably true. I didn't count, but it's probably true. Because I think at the end of the day, this country is about poets and philosophers, and it's not about generals. And most American Jews, and probably most British Jews also, when you wake them up in the middle of the night and say Israel, they think Palestinians, Iraq, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, occupation, borders, checkpoints. It's something that we deal with. It's not who we are. And I wanted American Jews and all the readers an English world, because the book is written in English, obviously, to understand Israel as the yearnings of a people for 2,000 years suddenly transformed into a political movement. And Bialik is part of that, and Ben-Gurion's part of that, and Jabotinsky's part of that, and Zachar Ha'am, and Berdichevsky, and so forth, to understand the yearnings that Jews had to reimagine what Jewish life could be. If American Jews read as many Israeli novels as they read political critiques of Israel, we'd be in much better shape. Because if they read Amos Oz, if they read David Grossman, if they read Eshkol Nevo or any of those books, they would have a sense that Israelis are also struggling with who do we want to be and how do we want to be. They wouldn't necessarily agree with us, but they would have a certain amount of pathos for us. And I think Israelis also need to understand the enormous nobility behind the American Jewish enterprise. Whatever challenges it may be facing, it's been an extraordinary experiment and an extraordinarily successful one since the massive wave of European Jews came to America just about a century ago. We have a lot to learn from each other. We need to understand each other much better.
So that's fascinating. So you're saying that a lot of the common ground can be found in the cultural area, literature, Judaism, philosophy. Really fascinating. I'd like to finish this interview by asking you if there is a makor, a Jewish source, which sort of inspires you and animates you on a regular basis. If there's maybe it's a verse or a biblical story, maybe it's a Talmudic passage, which is something which sort of gives you inspiration or gives you a particular challenge. We in Pardes, we're always focusing on Jewish texts. And I was just wondering if there is a particular Jewish text, it might be just this week, or it might be something which you sort of carry in your pocket always, which gives you some food for thought and some fuel as you go through everything that you do.
Well, since you're asking today, I'll just say that something occurred to me in shul this morning. As I mentioned to you earlier, for some crazy reason, got up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So unusually, by shachrit, I was wide awake. So normally I kind of just stumble through it, but this morning I was very awake in shul, and it's Thursday morning, so doing a long tachnun. And we got to this part, you know, Achenu kol Beit Yisrael, Hanutini Batzara, you know, may God take care of our brothers, the children of Israel who are, you know, are in distress and so on and so forth. And I thought to myself, how many people who don't say Tachanun or don't read the liturgy really get injected into them on a regular basis this notion of the indivisibility of the Jewish people? That even when we disagree with each other, in the morning we still say, Achenu Beit Yisrael, you know, our brothers, sisters, whatever, the house of Israel. It's a fundamental concept. And I was sitting there this morning davening and thinking, that's really important. And very often on Shabbat morning when I'm davening Shacharit, the piece that speaks to me most profoundly is during the Kedusha, Matay Timloch B'Tzion. And you said at the very, very beginning something about Judaism being a struggle. And I think there's a kind of a yearning. For me, what's really powerful about the liturgy is, and we could think of a thousand texts, whether they were Tanakh or Chazal, but you just sort of sprung this on me. But, you know, for me, what's powerful about liturgy is not that we're going shopping to God and, you know, I'd like a big red bicycle and I'd like a car that starts in the morning and all those kinds of things. But it's really about a sense of dreaminess. You know, so on Shabbat morning to say, Matayti Mloch B'Tzion, I mean, here we are sitting in Yerushalayim, it's rebuilt. It's an unbelievable success story. It's a rebirth of a people unlike anything else that the human race has ever seen. And yet the Jews manage on Shabbat morning to say, oh, but we're not done. We still need you to come back here and to kind of, we need you to rule here because whatever we've got here, it's not sufficiently godly. I love that you could be sitting in the rebuilt Western Jerusalem and surrounded by hundreds of minyanim on Shabbat morning, and it looks like Judaism pretty much fulfilled. And what do? We go to shul and say, God, we need you here because it's not what we need. And to say Achenu Beit Yisrael in the morning and on a Thursday morning in Tachanun is to say, you know, here we are, Jews of all different sorts, especially in this part of Yerushalayim, living together, and yet there's so much more to do to heal the Jewish people. So for me, it's the yearningness, it's the prayerfulness, it's the kind of dreaminess almost of the liturgy that at least at this particular stage of my life is speaking to me most powerfully.
Okay, wonderful. With that message of the unity of the Jewish people and dreaminess and hope, I think we will end our interview. And I just want to say a huge thank you for your time and for your insights and for your wisdom.
It's really a pleasure. I'm thankful for your invitation.
And we're really looking forward to a future relationship in Pardes and beyond. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. ELMAD.pardes.org.